Hi, thank you for joining us for another episode of Sociology Talk. We have some special guests here for today, and I'd like to have them introduce themselves. So I'll have them take it away.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sholan Chan Vasquez, and I teach sociology at the Santa Rosa Junior College.
And I am Daniel Miguel, and I am a sociology undergraduate student at Pomona College.
Yes, welcome. And so just kind of give you some background. I went to the California Sociological Association in Sacramento to present on the podcast. And I actually ran into Dr. Sholan and Daniel Miguel at the conference there. And so they were doing a presentation on research that they were doing. And I was really sucked in. So I appreciate you both coming on the podcast today. And I wanted to know, can you tell us a little bit about the research? I don't want to give any spoilers. So can you tell us a little bit about the research? Like what were you trying to explore? What made you to kind of investigate what you're doing?
The research kind of started based off of my background. I was born and raised as a Jehovah's Witness and was very involved in the organization. Was baptized in my young teenage years, became a minister in my early 20s, and essentially would be what you would call a true believer. Worked at helping bring other people into the organization, and that changed around 30. And then after that, kind of the course of refinding myself, rebuilding a new identity, a new belief system, got me to a point where I started researching articles and trying to find if other people had these similar experiences. And what I found was there wasn't much.
Yeah. Dr. Sholan, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, so I mean, I think your listeners would probably find this interesting because Daniel, was taking my introduction to sociology course. I believe it was his first, am I right about that, Daniel? Your first sociology course, like ever?
It was.
And I think it was probably a couple weeks into it, right? Maybe a month into it. And he came to my office hours and said, introduced himself and told me a little bit about his background, as a Jehovah's Witness, and said, I would love to research this. And I believe he had some, some experience with psychology. Maybe he thought about going into psychology, but then he decided that wasn't the right direction for him. So he kind of found his people and his community in sociology and said, this, I want to research this and I want to do it within the framework of sociology. And it really seemed like he had a kind of a full-blown research project already kind of formulating in his head. And he had done some readings and some research already. So we kind of jumped into, putting together a research project where we study Jehovah's Witnesses and what happens when they leave the organization. So this could be voluntary or involuntary exit. So disfellowshipping or exiting, as voluntary. Voluntarily exiting. So that's kind of our starting point. And do you want to turn it over to do you want can I turn it over to Daniel for to go deeper into like what some of our
Sure. I mean, I also want to point out I didn't realize what I had. It was really Dr. Sholan that helped me appreciate what she called my superpower in my lived experience as an ex or disfellowship Jehovah's Witness. And so I knew that I had interest in studying it, but I didn't really realize that it could become what is essentially my research now and our research, but also potentially my future research as I pursue finish my undergrad and then also pursue getting into a PhD program and continuing this. So from there, I'm not sure where you were going, Dr. Sholan.
I think the first concept you mentioned to me, or one of the first ones, was social death, right? So I had heard of this concept of social death before. I believe, Orlando Patterson talks about social death in the context of slavery. And also I had come across it, I believe, in the book Afro-Pessimism. So I had some experience with that that concept and what it meant. But when Daniel introduced it, I realized it had a slightly different meaning. He meant it in a different way. And that was this idea that when you leave a total institution, like a cult, right, you have to kind of shed your old identity and kind of it's almost like a rebirth, right? You have to then go through this complete resocialization process, which, Goffman, of course, talks about in Asylums in great detail and very, elaborately. And he calls it like a mortification of the self and then reprogramming of the self. And when I realized that that's what Daniel meant with this idea of social death, I was just fascinated because, what an interesting way of looking at it. What a painful experience this must be, right? For an ex Jehovah's Witness that has like who has to go through that. And then like in front of me, I had a person that had to go through that process and had emerged, alive and well and ready to kind of embark on a new journey. So I think social death was one of our first starting points.
Yeah, that is interesting. And so I always tell students, because I teach qualitative research methods, is that you have to find some, as Daniel mentioned, like some areas in the research or in the literature that isn't covered. And so he had gone out and said, well, I actually want to research my experience and see if anybody has a similar, if there's similar experiences out there that are happening. So it's really it's excellent that you've added to the literature, and have added to the conversation what needs to be talked about, because when I was when I was sitting there listening to it, it is a very important conversation to have. You did mention some concepts from Goffman, like mortification of the self. Can you tell us a little bit of how that is how that works within the context of the Jehovah's Witness religion, or I guess part of your project with Jehovah's Witness?
Sure. I think one of the things it's kind of it, as often the case, one thing leads to another understanding and so on and so forth. And so, as Dr. Sholem pointed out, it really was about the social death. That's kind of how it started. And then the connection was made kind of through her reading and her sharing with me some of what she had been reading about total institutions. And so then we started to really study total institutions and Goffman's understanding and description of what a total institution is, and realizing that the Organization of Jehovah's Witnesses operates very much like a total institution. And though Goffman describes, physical barriers to prisons and mental institutions, nursing homes, we found that the way that the Organization of Jehovah's Witnesses operates, they have essentially similar barriers, but they're symbolic, physical barriers, because the individuals within the organization, like myself growing up, I went to public school, I associated with people in those social circles or social settings, and then I left school, and then I started in the workforce, and again had associations and connection with those people, but we were never really connected. We were always steered away from those kind of friendships. Those individuals are labeled and framed as worldly individuals. And so they're not the type of people you establish long lasting relationships or deep connection with, because the fear, as it's presented, is always that they can pull you away from your worship or from the organization. And so everything becomes insular. Your community is within the Organization of Jehovah's Witnesses, your friends, your family, your social circles, and everything kind of gets tied around to that kind of single identity. We identify, or I should say they identify themselves. It's still very ingrained in me. But they identify themselves as Jehovah's Witnesses first and foremost. That is who they are. And so, it really is that kind of that framework or that hierarchy and structure of a total institution that can create, and we're finding this more and more in the research as we continue and continue to do interviews, structured interviews with ex-witnesses, that's the case. There are almost levels to this social death. And it's been quite eye-opening because, again, not everyone's experience is like mine, but there are a lot of similarities. And it all connects again back to that structure.
Yeah, I think if I may add, as Daniel said, total institutions are enclosed, in structures, right? Buildings, like the way Goffman talks about them, obviously asylums or prisons. But when we started talking about Jehovah's Witnesses as a total institution, we realized, we ended up phrasing it shame as a barbed wire. So it's, kind of this whole conglomeration of, the believers themselves, the elders, right? And even the self, right, that keeps telling you, you shouldn't cross over. You cannot do this. You can't present yourself in this way, right? Even, what Bourdieu would call habitus, right? The way you talk, the way you dress, right? The way you behave, all of that is prescribed by the organization and how they want the believers to present themselves. So that all kind of creates this total control and power on the individual, on the self, which then, at the time of exit, of course, you're kind of fish out of water. When you're thrown into the real world, you have no experience with the real, even though you've been living in the real world, right? It's this kind of isolated world because of the discouragement of worldliness and association with worldly people. So when you're thrown into it, it's almost like, I think some of our respondents called it like feeling like an alien, right? Just completely feeling like a stranger in society, right? In greater society after they exit.
And it's so, I feel like it's so contemporary, like the whole idea of the total institutions and asylums. You had mentioned that they're like, they're structures, they're physical structures, but it seems like within this situation, it's more of like in a total institution of the mind, like something that's not tangible, that you can't really see, but it still operates like a total institution. So it's really interesting. And so what can you tell me, was there any like significant patterns that you saw for the reasons why somebody might leave the religion?
Yeah, it's and you know what, I'm gonna reference Helen Rose Ebaugh, who wrote kind of what has become the foundation of our research, which is entitled "Becoming an X: The Process of Role Exit." She herself was a former nun and left that service, and then continued on into the academic world. And she wrote and talked a lot about different aspects of role exit. And so a lot of that has become the framework. She even mapped out in her book kind of stages. But the stages that she mapped out were what we might call voluntary role exit, or what she called voluntary role exit, where an individual has the ability to kind of disengage, that they know that they're this isn't quite right for them, but they're not quite ready to leave. And so they begin to, as they detach from one, they begin to attach to other social circles or structures. And so over time, they're able to kind of process that entire aspect of role change or role exit. And so what we did find is that there are many ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, and some of which that we interviewed, that had a kind of a similar process of leaving the organization, in that they, due to maybe changes the organization had made that they no longer agreed with, or they started to struggle with the beliefs, specific aspects of maybe certain teachings that didn't quite feel right and sit right with them. One of such individuals that we had the privilege of interviewing was an ex-witness and an author who wrote a book entitled Shunned. Her name is Linda Curtis, and we did reference her in our presentation, and had the privilege after that of actually interviewing Linda and getting more on her story. But it was for Linda's experience, it was one single belief that kind of began to unravel the entire belief system for her. And her exit process took years. Mostly because even though she no longer believed, she knew the consequences were that she was going to lose her entire family. She would lose her community. She would lose that connection. And so for most witnesses, that is one of the most damaging things is losing your family, in a sense where it almost feels like your death. And another individual we interviewed, even it's kind of the phrase he used, it's like attending your own funeral. And so that's kind of one aspect. We'll say one end of the spectrum in role exit, where you have the ability to disengage, and then over time you're reestablishing. So you kind of transition into a new role. Doesn't mean it's painless, but the level of social death seems to be a little bit lighter. And then other individuals who are experiencing disfellowshipping. And for a lot of these, we would say that these are potentially individuals that are physically in, mentally in. And so with them, the role exit process just happens instantly. There's no time for them to process, to disengage, to begin to let go. They are literally just cut off immediately. From the organization, from the community. That's the term disfellowshipping is, it's a judicial term that essentially that's what it defines, is a completely cutting off an individual and pushing them out. And so that's the other end of that spectrum. And we found that the kind of level of social death for those individuals is much more severe, because in most cases, it's not that they stopped believing, they just made a mistake, and that mistake was punishable with a disfellowshipping practice.
Interesting. Yeah. And do you have any examples of how maybe somebody would be fall under disfellowship? That would be like the immediate cut off of ties, right? From the religion.
Yeah, there are, I mean, and it within the organization, there are loose definitions as far as things that are punishable by being disfellowshipped, you know, what kind of actions. There are individuals that can commit adultery or fornication. And depending upon the body, which is three men who you sit before and they are your judicial committee, they decide your level of repentance and your level of forgiveness. And if they deem that you are repentant and forgive and are forgivable, then they can choose to what is called reproof, which is a step down from disfellowshipping, which means you still have contact, you're still within the organization. It's almost like a slap on the wrist. There are some other consequences that go along with it, but they're minimal in comparison. That same body can sit across an individual and decide that they're not repentant. And so they're not in a position to be forgiven, and that's when they would be disfellowshipped. And so oftentimes it's just up to the committee of three men that are going to decide the individual's fate in that instance. So there are certain things that some would say are disfellowshipping offenses, but it doesn't mean everyone gets disfellowshipped for committing them. So in a sense, it's a little bit of a crapshoot. You kind of roll the dice and hope you get the right three men.
And so yeah, that's really interesting. And so I'll have to pick up that book by Linda Curtis, as you mentioned. And you mentioned her exiting from a religion was a little bit slower. I guess do you when that happens, and I don't want to, I'll pick up the book definitely, but when that happens to somebody, do they have to hide that information? Like, oh, I'm planning on exiting, or maybe I'm having, thoughts that this isn't correct. And I guess how does that? I'm not sure if you have like a lot of experiences or if that's
Yeah,
something.
we do
What is
actually.
that
I've
like?
got two that Linda's, and then one that's sadly the polar opposite. So yeah, with Linda, she did. She talks about it in her memoir that she had to keep that to herself. She essentially lived this life away from her family that she did not let them know about until she was ready. And so it, for her, she was able to do that a little bit longer because her family and where she had been a part of the organization was in one state and city, and she had moved to another state and city for work, for a career opportunity. And so she was able to hide that a little bit longer. Whereas for individuals that stay within the community, that it gets exposed fairly quickly. But then another individual that we interviewed was a young man. He had a single doubt and question about something. He brought it to his mother, who was a witness in the organization. She got scared at the question, took it to her husband, who was his stepfather. And then the stepfather took it to the elders in the congregation, and they met with this individual and disfellowshipped him immediately because they deemed his question, it teetered on the level of apostasy. And so they immediately concluded he was a danger to the organization and danger to other people's beliefs.
Interesting. And was he underage or?
He was, no, at the time he was 21.
Okay.
And so he's in his 50s now, mid-50s. So this is many, many years ago, but it still affects him. In the interview, he still talks about, the loss of specifically the relationship with his mother.
Interesting.
I
And so
think,
I guess, oh, sorry, go ahead,
sorry.
Chilin.
Another example is, just any sort of sexual orientation or sexuality that deviates from the heterosexual norm, right? One of our interviewees, identifies as gay, and they found out early, in their teenage years that they were attracted to women, and and they just couldn't find a way to authentically experience or express their sexuality within the religion, so they had no choice. But to leave, and they ended up being, disfellowshipped. There are different examples, and some, I think we found one sociological article, where they talk about, young people, right, like in their, early teens or late teens, deciding, this is just too restrictive, and I don't want to live like this, and kind of exiting voluntarily. So I think, we're also finding this spectrum of, severe social death. If someone has been born into the organization, has lived in the organization their entire lives, most of their family and friends are in the organization, and they have a deep sense of belief, and for whatever reason they get, disfellowshipped for, deviating from some of the prescribed norms. That's a very severe case of social death. We're proposing. And then someone maybe who joined later or didn't have the deep bonds that some others may have, then they exit, and their social death, if you want to call it, might be milder case. So there's kind of a spectrum of different experiences.
There's got to be like certain unique experiences there. And yeah, that was actually one of my next questions was, I guess, how early can somebody be, or I guess, experience the disfellowship? And you said it could be pretty early, and depending on if they say, oh, it's too restrictive and I just want to leave. Oh, sorry, let me get this out of the way. So it can be, as early as what age do you think? Like, you can be under the age of 18, or like how would somebody experience the disfellowship? Is there like a certain age restriction? Like, you can't be disfellowshipped after 18 years old, or is that not something that applies?
No, a anyone at any time can be disfellowshipped. I do want to clarify. In order to be disfellowshipped, one has to be baptized into the organization. And so baptism within the organization of Jehovah's Witnesses is a lot different from other contemporary Christian religions. It is voluntary, it's something you study towards. And so generally, I think the youngest person that we interviewed was baptized at 8 years old, which was extremely, extremely young. The majority of the individuals who are born and raised into the organization are baptized in their teenage years. Anywhere from, 13 to 18 seems to be a heavy concentration. And then for individuals that come from the outside, they could be baptized in their 50s and 60s. I think my step grandfather got baptized at 82. So he was much later in life. And so you have to be baptized in order to be disfellowshipped. If you never get baptized, it's not to say that there aren't consequences, but they're there really isn't anything from the organization standpoint that they can do to an individual other than label them as a danger or a bad person.
But does the family still need to cut ties with them?
No,
No.
that's the crazy thing. One of the interviewees that we interviewed, actually the one that you mentioned earlier, Dr. Sholon, that kind of referenced himself to feeling like an alien, like he doesn't belong anywhere anymore. He was the youngest of three children. His middle sibling, or the one right above him, was never baptized, got involved in drugs, and a very difficult, challenged life this individual has led. Still has a relationship with their parents, in fact has lived with his parents off and on over the years. He did get baptized and was disfellowshipped in his early 20s and is still struggling to this day, has some severe mental health issues due to the loss of that family connection.
Interesting. And so I've heard a lot of stories about the it sounds like you've interviewed a lot of people about their experiences, and you kind of have like a really good, I mean, you have a really good understanding of like the patterns that are emerging or have emerged. I guess my next question is, how do you locate the participants? Like, do you just do it by who you know, or do people reach out to you, or how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, it started off, I'm glad you asked, because whoever is listens to this and to your podcast, if you are an ex-Jehovah's Witness and are interested in being a part of our research project, we would love to hear your story and have your experience shared so that we can add it to our understanding of what happens to individuals once they leave the organization. But the research so far to this point really has survived off of kind of snowball samples of former connections and friends and individuals that I've met over the years as I've moved all over the country that I seem to stumble into somehow that, were at one time raised in the same organization or are no longer a part of it, who have shared their stories with me. We've started to reach out via social media platforms. That's been a little more challenging at this point, but we're not giving up on it. Our goal and hope is really to kind of study this even on an international level, because the Organization of Jehovah's Witnesses touts itself to be an international organization. We really want to know what people's experiences are that grew up in Europe and Africa and South America within the organization and see where the similarities are and where the differences lie. So that's our ultimate goal, is to really expand this globally.
Interesting. Okay. Dr. Sholan, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I nice plug, Daniel. So anyone, if you're a former Jehovah's Witness and would like to reach out to either of us, we'd be happy to interview you. Would love that. And also, yeah, to add to that point where, snowball, as we know, snowball sampling has its limitations, right? We kind of come up to a point where we're only interviewing people with, similar backgrounds or live in a geographical area. So, we want to also expand to the East Coast or Midwest, right? Like different parts of the US, but also globally. Yeah, there's some research. There seems to be some research happening globally. But of course, we want to make it, sociological research, and we have a very specific focus, even though, it's a broad type of research into JWs. So yeah, it's been kind of a challenge recruiting new interviewees.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, hopefully we can get some people who are listening to reach out to you. If you don't mind, I'll put your contact information in the description so that way they can reach out to you.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
That'd be
you got
great.
it. I know you had mentioned that one of the goals was to really get an international perspective on this experience. When you walked in, I guess Daniel, this question is for you. When you walked into Dr. Sholan's office, was that the goal that you had in mind? Was that I want to just understand this at a global level, or just, I guess, what was your overall goal when you wanted to jump into this research project?
I mean, I wish I could tell you that I had that much savvy and understanding of things, but the truth is, Andreas, I'd never been to college. I think that was my second semester at college. So I'm still learning. I still feel very green as far as understanding academia and the implications and connections, how far things could go. Really, it was Dr. Charon who helped me see, the potential of this and kind of set my course, to get started, and has really been there as part of this process the entire way. So I just knew that I had this experience that was the most challenging in my life. I'd gotten to a good place with it, but then started to realize that so many other people had shared experiences, and I wanted to understand how I could help them more. And so that's what brought me to her office hours.
Okay, interesting.
I mean, I think thank you, Daniel. And I don't know. I mean, you already, had done a lot and done a lot of reading and research. So I'll give the credit back to you. But I really, I just want to say that as a discipline, I think, historically, of course, like we've always valued detachment from our subject, right? Like let's study something that doesn't really apply to me, or let's, have the objective lens and all of that, right? Which is very valuable, not to say that that's not valuable, but I really love this idea of, going back to our individual experiences, our personal experiences, and really, using sociology to understand what we're going through, right? How the structures have been acting upon us, right? I think that's something that happens in the classroom too. All of a sudden, my students, we talk about poverty, right? And they make better sense of some of the forces in their lives that are, that have been restricting them or confining them. And I think I really love that, Daniel, in a way, right, this is a personal experience that he's now using his personal experiences to make sense of it and in a greater framework, in a sociological framework. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. And I wanted to add one more thing, and now it's not coming to me. So I'll leave it at that. But yeah, I guess maybe if it's time for that, I don't want to go too much further. The implications of this to me are immense, right? I mean, I'm not a micro sociologist. I've never really kind of, I knew of Goffman. I had read some of his work, for example, but, I don't consider myself a micro sociologist. But this idea of self and thinking about oneself, right, within the sociological forces and structures and frameworks, it's almost like I, as a sociologist, right, had this awakening all of a sudden into, oh, this is super cool, and it could be really helpful to people to kind of develop this lens, right? Every single experience that we've had, right, matters, and it, and it's also shaped by social forces, obviously. So, I'm an immigrant, for example, right? So when Daniel was telling me a little bit about this idea of social death, I can relate to it as an immigrant to a certain extent, because maybe it wasn't complete social death, but I definitely felt like when I moved here from Turkey, right? I'm an immigrant from Turkey to the US, and I had to kind of shed a certain level of skin, right? Certain aspects of myself, my social identity, to kind of start fitting in it into my life here. And then, I go back and forth. So, we talk about code switching, right, in sociology quite a lot these days. But, I also think that it can apply to immigration, immigrant experiences. It can apply to prison reentry processes, right? Helen Rose Ebaugh talks about, even divorce, right? Kind of the exit from the social institution of marriage can be, is a role exit and has severe consequences, right, for the self. So it has, I think, very wide implications and possible applications.
Yeah, I think so as well. That's one of the reasons I fell in love with sociology was that I was able to kind of make sense of my own experiences in like a sociological way or through a sociological perspective. And I think it's great that you're using it to help others that maybe have been experiencing a similar situation. And so I guess is the reason that you wanted to help them is because the adjusting to the outside world of JW or Jehovah's Witness was very difficult. And I guess what does that look like?
Yeah, for individuals that experience the disfellowshipping and experience that in involuntary exit, they struggle the most. And part of the reason being, well, let me clarify. Dr. Sholon helped to identify really kind of four pathways, and so the ones that struggled or suffered the most severe social death are the individuals that were born into the organization and then also experienced disfellowshipping or involuntary exit. And that essentially is because all of the role and behaviors that they learned were learned or that fit within the socializing of that organization. And so once they leave it, they're trying to relearn new social roles or new social behaviors along with an entire belief system, reestablish friendships. And that's why one of the interviewees described it as feeling like an alien, like he doesn't fit here, but he also doesn't fit anywhere over here. And so he's kind of in this in between. And so a lot of witnesses struggle with that because, and part of that I think has a lot to do with, you're fed that these people on the outside are a danger to you. They're bad people. And so that sticks with you somehow, to a certain extent. And I think, causes you, in my own experience, to keep people at arm's length, for a long time, just because you're not sure, what the expectations are going to be or how to even engage them often. So I think one of the other things that we discovered that has been really interesting that has definitely had kind of an effect is what we are theorizing is a master status identity, different from how it's potentially been used in the past in sociological terms. But the way that we're referring to it is kind of a single identity that becomes more important than any ascribed or achieved statuses. It's one that's central to roles, to behaviors, to all of our interactions. So how we might view statuses as they are often used is, we might have class or gender or sexuality and race. And so around those statuses, there are roles that are attached, that go with each of those statuses. And we play along with those in a sense. We may identify in certain ways with that. But what happens when we lose one of those? We still have these other pieces of our identity that we can kind of rely on, as that one that's lost can be replaced, or when we experience role exit. But if you have a master status, one that essentially becomes the sun around which all other roles and status revolve, and then you lose that, and that's when we're talking about that severe mortification, that severe social death, because everything was associated with that one, and then it just crumbles, and now you have to completely rebuild. And so those, again, that's the severe end of that spectrum for what these individuals, these ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, are experiencing.
Interesting.
I think at the risk of repetition, that concept of worldliness or the discouragement of worldliness is, I think, key, right? Because as a Jehovah's Witness, you grow up only associating with other Jehovah's Witnesses, or if you associate with others, that's discouraged. And so is higher education is also discouraged, right? Jehovah's Witnesses
Yes.
are directed towards more vocational jobs rather than professional jobs. So you can imagine that that connects to social class, right? You can probably only earn so much or reach a certain status in society, right? If you're a Jehovah's Witness. And so marriage prospects, right? You can only marry another Jehovah's Witness, right? You got to raise your children within that concept. So it's the exit, as we argue, is disastrous, right? Because
Terrible.
you are literally kind of being thrown into a world that you don't really know. You don't really know how to associate with the people in that world. You may not have a job that's not outside of the Jehovah's Witness organization. You don't have higher education, so you have to maybe go back and do that, go back to school. It's kind of connected to everything, and like all of our life chances are affected by that.
Yeah. And as you were saying this, I just kind of like thought of the concept of like a anomie, like Durkheim's anomie. Like it just feels like something that you're just so used to living this everyday life is now pulled from underneath you. And it's like the ground crumbles, you know. And I think I love the illustration by Daniel. It says like this, like the sun, and then that just goes away and everything just kind of crumbles around it. And I feel like that's like, yeah, it makes sense that those that are immediately cut off have a much more difficult time, whereas those that may be gradually considering the exit have maybe have adjusted or consider or had certain strategies or techniques that allow them to successfully and health in a healthy way like move away from that master identity, you know. So they might be, I guess this is kind of my thought, that might be like why they've have much more easier time. Would you say that's kind of what's happening?
Yeah, I think the research and the is showing that. And again, it's still a very difficult process even for them. Again, mentioning Linda Curtis's story, like it took her years to get to a point where she was mentally and emotionally, psychologically prepared to lose her family, even though she knew that that was coming for years and years and years. So the loss is still there, but it does. So far, the research is showing that for individuals that have the ability to disengage and begin to detach from that role, all in those same ways, psychologically, emotionally, mentally, that they do have an easier time moving on and re-socializing and finding a new social network. Interesting.
And to give one more example, one of our interviewees raised, she was a mother, and she said, now I have to raise my children, with no ties to their grandparents, right? So, cutting ties with family, it's not just parents, but you have to cut ties with, your children also lose their ties to their family. So, that sense of isolation, I think, also is extremely powerful for them.
Yeah, to the point, if I may, Andres, add to that, it is powerful to the point where many of the individuals we've interviewed have been disfellowshipped more than once. So they get kicked out, they come back because of the need for that attachment and get kicked out again. And in some cases, I think there was two of the interviewees, the third time was essentially the charm. By the third time, they realized that they were in a place where they no longer needed that. And maybe that's not the right way of putting that. That need is still there, but they were okay, and found comfort in moving on and losing those attachments.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. And so I don't like I just think this is so fascinating. I think we can talk about this for hours. But I don't want to keep you all here. I just wanted to kind of end it with maybe some advice you would like to give somebody that is potentially pursuing something, some form of research for themselves or maybe to just kind of help people, or just something similar to what you, how, why you wanted to do it. I guess what advice would you give somebody going into research at, you had said that it was, you had been in college for 2 months, I think you said.
It's second semester.
Or,
It was the
okay,
start of
second.
the second semester. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think from my perspective, you know, finding something that you're interested in, and whether that is a personal connection or experience that you have had, begin to look to see if research has been done on it, if it's been written about, and even if it has, the understanding we're constantly changing, our society is constantly changing. So yeah, I've even things that have been published within the last 10, 15 years, that we've started to read, we realize maybe need some updating, and so there's opportunity there. But definitely finding something that you are truly interested in, and then finding someone who is supportive of that. I feel like I was very fortunate to have found Dr. Sholan and had taken her class, because I don't know, at the junior college level, if anyone else would have encouraged me to start doing research, in my second semester of school. And so I think that's really important too, is finding someone that is willing to mentor and kind of guide you and encourage the process. And I think that's how we ended up here today. So.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, along the same lines, right? Go to those office hours, introduce yourself, to the students that are listening, right? Introduce yourselves to to professors, and if you have a story, tell that story. And if the first person's not responsive, keep trying. And I know it's intimidating. I know students get really shy and intimidated by professors, but we're cool, some of us, right? We don't fight always. So take advantage of that. And and I think also, even when I was in grad school, and I don't know what your experience was like, Andres, but nobody really told me, like you can publish this or maybe send this in for as a possible publication. Looking back at some of my papers, I mean, they're not the best written papers in the world or anything like that. But I could have tried, right? And going through that experience would have taught me something. But no, nobody, I mean, there's this almost like, right, hierarchy of, you're only in junior college, you're only in undergrad, you're only in grad school. Don't do that yet, but like go to the conferences, put your papers in for to present, because what's the worst that can happen, number one. And also, just the experience itself is teaches you something, right? And when we presented, I think it was rewarding for Daniel, I hope. And also, we got to actually find someone in the audience. I don't know if you remember this, Andres, who
Go ahead.
had a personal experience, right? And so they were able to kind of make that connection with Daniel. So you'll help people along the way, but students, don't be shy. Don't be discouraged. Just tell your stories.
That's excellent. Yeah, I really appreciate the advice that you both gave. And yeah, I have a similar experience with that. It just kind of, when I first started researching, I didn't actually come into sociology. I mean, I came into the master's of sociology from the background of liberal studies. So my research experience was super limited. Like, I was very, to a point where it was difficult for me to even navigate a database. Like, that's how behind I was. And so I had to catch up by a lot, and I always kind of thought that it was very daunting to, go out and do this research on your own. But, something told me, like, I really want to try this and I really want to do this. And I stuck around with it, and I did it. Unfortunately, I didn't publish it because I chose to do it on technology, which to my experience was very difficult, because technology then changes very quickly. And so I guess my advice to people out there that are doing research on technology is to publish it right away, because then it just gets outdated. So to kind of, I wrote my research on Facebook, why people create a Facebook account, and focus specifically on college students. So yeah, it was interesting. And so I really appreciate your advice. Likely I also appreciate you both coming on and sharing with us your research, your experience. I'll make sure to include your contact information, if that's okay, below in the description, so people can kind of go through and click on it. If they'd like to contribute to the project, then they can reach out to you.
Yes,
That'd be
please.
great. Yes. Thank you
All
so
right.
much for having us on.
Yeah, you got it. You have a great day.
You as well.
Thank you, Andres.
Hey, thanks for listening. For more stories about sociologists, please subscribe. Until next time.